Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and today we're going to take a look, among other things, at leaf diseases, cold injury to trees and other plants with our two guests. Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of Plant Pathology. And Brian, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
And Lisa Johnson. Lisa is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. And Lisa, it's always great to see you.
Great to see you, too.
In fact, I think it's the first time the three of us have been together since the Garden Expo, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's true. Yep.
Well, we'll do our song and dance today then.
Yeah, here we are again.
Let's do it again. Oh, man. Well, what about diseases, leaf diseases? What kinds are we seeing this time of the year, Brian?
All kinds. Actually, we've had a good spring for leaf diseases because we've had a fair amount of rain in many areas of the state. So I'm seeing a lot of apple scab on crab apples and apple trees. Pears are also very susceptible to that disease. And if you have a susceptible variety, it will probably be defoliated in the next couple of weeks. So watch for that if you've got a bear crab apple.
You're always such an, you know.
I know, yes. The bearer of doom and gloom. Yes.
Dr. Death, thank
I live,
you.
Yes, that's right. That is my handle. We've been seeing a lot of anthracnose, which is a disease that we see on a variety of different types of plants. There are actually a lot of different anthracnose diseases. I've been seeing it on oaks and ash trees. If you see brown blotches on those sorts of leaves, that's probably what you're dealing with. A lot of cedar apple rust, also on crab apples, hawthorns, apple trees. Those make very, actually pretty spots, bright yellow to orange. They're relatively small right now, but they'll get larger as we progress through the season. So a lot of activity, and these are all fungal diseases.
Well, we have Ron and Cable with an interesting question. I think I'm going to turn this one over to Lisa. Ron, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning. By the way, really appreciate the shows, Larry. This is another great one, as usual.
Thank you.
But in any event, this might stump our guests. I hope not. We had some suspicious worms on our garage and around the yard this past week, and we're going to call the DNR. Because we have a very healthy little maple tree on the lakeside of our house, and we saw all these leaves dropping off periodically. Then I went to observe them, and there were little branches that were actually bitten off. And so we cleaned them up, and this happened again. And so then my wife, again, unrelated to a disease, might be a diseased squirrel because the squirrel was biting them off.
Yeah.
And drop them. This has been happening for the last week. So, again, not related to a disease, but again, we got this squirrel doing this. I've never seen that before. We've had many squirrels in our yard. So, my question is, what's going on?
Well, actually, it's not all that uncommon. The squirrel is harvesting branches usually to make a nest, and they will chew off small twigs and then later, theoretically, at least come down and collect them. Sometimes you will see squirrels earlier in the season chewing on maple branches and then licking up the sap as it comes out and enjoying that kind of sugary treat. But this time of year, they're probably doing it to get that nesting material. We have a great publication on squirrels at the Learning Store that has some of this information on it, too. So if you Google Learning Store,
okay.
UWEX, and you look under the wildlife section, you
or
should be able
to. Or just type squirrel.
Yeah, or just type squirrel. That ought to do it. Yeah, I've had this happen before, too, and it's rather annoying for a while, and then the squirrel gets its nest built and moves on to other
annoying
things.
It's not only maples, too. I've seen it on spruce on occasion,
ash,
too. I think
sometimes they're
feeding to a certain extent as well.
Yeah, I think they are feeding sometimes, too.
Well, I guess we live in the woods, and of all the trees...
They got to take that one, don't they, Ron?
All the trees, and it's just that we have nesting squirrels in the area, and this one's more exposed. The tree is actually more exposed than any other trees because it's out in the lawn area and where we have a couple acres of woods behind us. So, but anyway, I was kind of assuming that, but I want to hear from the experts, and I think that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. On my jog this morning, I saw it many, many times along the sidewalks through the neighborhood. They're busy this time of year, Ron. Thanks a lot for calling, by the way. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org. Or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. And if you have a photo, post it up on our Facebook page of a diseased plant or tree. We'd certainly love to see that as well. And as a matter of fact, we had a listener post a photo a few weeks back of a cedar tree with an orange-colored spiny growth on the branches.
And it's one of my favorite diseases, actually. It's most likely cedar apple rust, and it's not truly a cedar. It's really a juniper. They're called red cedars, but they're really junipers, and this is a disease that occurs on junipers. It's actually what's called an alternating rust disease because it spends part of its life cycle on junipers, the rest of it on apples, crabapples, hawthorns, and I actually already mentioned those bright color spots. That's actually the alternate phase of the disease on these other hosts. But on junipers and particularly red cedar, you get these huge brown galls, and then around mid-May to mid-June, they'll sprout these beautiful gelatinous masses. Sometimes they look like orange octopus tentacles.
Beauty's in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah,
there.
Well, compared to the black and brown and slimy, disgusting stuff that I see the rest of the time, this is kind of pretty. And actually, the head of grounds came into my office one year around this time and had talked to a student who said that this was her favorite time of the year because this is when the junipers were blooming, and thought that this fungal mass was actually a flower. So
there we go.
I guess it is in the eye of the beholder.
Oh, man. Pam in Kellogg, Minnesota, up next. Pam, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I have been gardening for about a million years and have tried about every tomato cage there is. I'm having my husband make some now out of rebar, but I have tried everything you can buy, and you know they either fall over or end up in the ground every year. So I wondered if any of the listeners had a really good one that really keeps them up off the ground.
Well, mine keep them up off the ground, but mine are just plain old, well, they're painted a nice bright colors, but they're just wire outfits, and I don't have any trouble with mine.
You need to have them, you need to have something, obviously, that's big enough for the job, and I think rebar definitely is going to be strong enough for you. Do you use tomato clips at all to help clip them to the supports? Or do you use ties? Or
no, I haven't done that. I've tried the nylons, tying them up that way, but a lot of times the branches will break off. They get
some
heavy things on them.
Yeah, tomato cages are good. You just need to get them big enough, and you need to keep up with the pruning of the tomato over the year, so taking off the suckers may help with the branch support issue. I feel some years like, you know, okay, it's 3 days later, and here I am clipping the tomato up again.
Right.
So keeping up with it is also helpful.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. There are a ton of different support systems up there, and I bet you get 10 different people will swear by 10 different methods.
Rebar is going to hold it up.
Yeah, it definitely should.
As long as you get it into the ground deep enough, you're going to be fine. Good luck, Pam. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We have Bob in Elko, I think. Bob, where are you from?
Hi, Bob from Elko, Wisconsin.
All right.
I have birch trees that are infested with leaf miners. Can't get rid of them. And don't know what to do with them.
All righty. How
serious of a problem is it? Because oftentimes certain leaf miners can be somewhat cosmetic. How much does it bother you, I guess, is the other question.
Well, these are small, young birch trees. And
okay.
Then it's a problem. If it were older trees, that's why I asked that question.
Yeah,
because sometimes the best thing is sometimes to ignore some of these things that are a problem. Lisa's trying to look up some information real quick because this is certainly not my area of expertise. If we can't find anything real quick, then what I'm going to suggest you do is give our insect diagnostician a call. His name is PJ Leash. He'll probably kill me for giving his phone number off on the air.
Oh, I do it all the time.
Okay. It's 608-262-6510. And he's my counterpart in the insect world.
Okay. Yeah, PJ is great. I remember Phil Pelletieri saying that with leaf miners, that they follow that typical kind of bell-shaped curve in population, that some years you have a lot of them, and then a few years later the population will go down. And like Brian said, most of the time they're more of a cosmetic issue, but when you do have a young tree with limited numbers of leaves, then it can become an issue. I suspect PJ will tell you to probably use a systemic product of some kind.
But again, I suspect the timing is too late at this point, would be my guess, if you're already seeing the damage.
Yeah.
But he can help you with that.
Yeah.
There you go.
And I think we also have a fact sheet on it. I was looking through my fact sheet book, but I think on Learning Store, I think there might be something on birch leaf miner.
So learningstore.uwex.edu.
That's
go
the
there and then look under.
Type in birch leaf miner.
Type in birch leaf miner. You'll probably get a quick answer there, too. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call, Bob. And Judy in Madison. Judy, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking the call. This is a little off topic, I guess, but I have a question about ants. I get ants in the grass. I get ants in the flower beds in the garden. And my question isn't how to get rid of them as much as how harmful they are. They climb up and down the maple tree. They are they harmful or more harmful or more helpful to plants?
Yeah, what you may be seeing with the ones that are going up and down the trees may be that you have aphids in the tree, and they actually, some of the ants will actually use the aphid feces. And they will actually kind of tend the aphids, and they use that feces as a food source. So that may be some of the reason why you're seeing the movement up and down the trees. I know PJ mentioned that.
Yeah, unless, recently, of course, they're carpenter ants. And
then you may have some wood rot in the tree, but the ant is really not the problem. Even if you have carpenter ant, that's not really the problem with the tree.
Right.
There's some sort of fungal decay that's going on that's softening the wood, and that makes it attractive to the carpenter ants getting inside the tree. So you have a bigger problem than the ants if you're seeing those types of ants. And I know that
flowers and vegetables.
Yeah, now that's more of a problem because it can disrupt the root system and dry it out and so on. I usually ants on trees, as long as they're not carpenter ants, I really don't see a problem with it. But vegetables and flowers definitely can be kind of uprooted and so on, so it can be a problem with that. Now you do often see ants on peonies as well. That's not usually an issue unless they've got a nest right at the root zone. It's not even, you know, seeing a few ants on the plant is not a problem. It's the nest that's in the root zone that's the problem.
Yeah. And I remember one time Phil talking about certain types of ants that will actually inject formic acid into the roots of plants because they don't
kill
want their
nest.
Yeah, they don't want their nest shaded, and so that's the way they get rid of the plant, is to actually inject formic acid into the roots.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking today with Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson from the University of Wisconsin. Lisa, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. And Brian directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer. Actually, Malik Anderson's our on-air producer. Jill Nadeau, our producer here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next week on Garden Talk, Melinda Myers comes back. It's been a long time since she's been on the show, and she will be answering your gardening questions, so I hope you tune in for that. Right now, taking a look at leaf diseases, cold injury, and other plant issues with our two guests, Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson. All our lines are filled. The number is 800-642-1234. If you've got a plant disease and maybe you have a photo of it, post it up on our Facebook page with your question. The Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. You don't even have to be a member of Facebook to do that. And email us as well at talk@wpr.org. On to Steve in Green Bay. Steve, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have two oak trees growing out of the same base unit, about a foot in diameter at the base each. And over the years, they've been losing leaves, and finally it got to the point where the bark's all fallen off and the leaves are gone. So I dropped the two trees down and expecting to see kind of like a pulpy substance in there. But the wood was perfectly hard and but perfectly dry also, where oak is kind of a reddish hue when it's fresh like that. I'm just wondering what would cause something like
was
that.
Was it a red oak or a white oak?
No, it was a white oak.
White oak, okay.
Yeah, the first disease to come to mind, seeing that the tree is totally dead, would be potentially oak wilt. That's a very common fungal disease that we see. The fungus is introduced into the tree typically in an area, if it's a first case, by sap beetles. They actually visit infected trees and then feed on the sap, and they can pick up the spores of the fungus as they do that. And then they'll move to other trees. They visit wounded trees and then, again, drop off the spores. The fungus gets into the water-conducting tissue and blocks it off or induces blockages. Sometimes it's the tree that's contributing to the problem itself. And then that eventually will lead to the decline and death of the tree. And it can be very rapid, much more rapid usually in red oaks than in white oaks.
What was that called again?
It's called oak wilt. Oak wilt.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The other disease that I would worry a little bit, if it was a much slower death over many years, would be a disease called armillaria root disease. This is a kind of a creepy fungus because it colonizes trees, and then it produces these structures that look kind of like roots. They're called rhizomorphs. They're root-like, and they're kind of like feelers, so it's actually kind of searching out other root systems in the vicinity. And then it tends to come in through wounds, or it can invade trees that are under a lot of stress. And then it colonizes under the bark at the base of the tree and eventually will kill the tree. And then the bark will slough off after as the disease progresses. Mm-hmm. But that's another one. With that one, you typically start to see little what are called honey mushrooms that will form in the vicinity of the infected tree. So if you see these little tannish sort of mushrooms, about maybe 4 to 6 inches tall, sometimes it looks like the caps are sprinkled with cinnamon. That could definitely be what you're dealing with as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you have other oak trees in the near vicinity?
Yes, I have a lot of oak trees.
Okay. Other white oaks or other, they red?
There's a mixture.
Okay. My concern with oak wilt is that once it gets into an area, it can actually move from tree to tree by root graft. So your white oaks, all of the root systems are going to be kind of merged together into a single water conducting unit, and the fungus can move from tree to tree that way. Are you seeing any signs of decline in any of your other white oaks that are close to the one that's died?
There's a really large one that has a dead branch here and there going up the tree, which is kind of typical of oaks.
Mm-hmm.
And then the wind breaks them and they hang for a while before they drop. This is real sandy soil.
Okay.
I don't know if that has any effect.
The other thing is on those sandier soils, trees can go under stress. We had a drought back in 2012, and that can stress the trees to the point where there is an insect pest that will come in that's called two-line chestnut borer, and that can eventually cause the trees to die as well. It usually is kind of the final straw that'll kind of push the tree over the edge. You can kind of get a sense of whether that's there, though. If you look underneath the bark on that wood, you'll see trails where the larvae have fed. And so if you see kind of a network of kind of random tunnels underneath the bark, that could be what you were dealing with as well. There are several things. If you think you have oak wilt, I would really suggest getting a sample into my clinic for testing to verify, because if you have that disease, you need to be very aggressive, particularly in wooded areas, mm-hmm. to make sure you limit the spread of that particular disease organism.
There are things you can try and things you can do.
Yeah, in a grove like that, you'd probably want to do trenching to break root grafts and then remove trees. But quite frankly, before you trench, you need to know whether you're dealing with oak wilt or armillaria, because if you've got armillaria, that's the primary problem. You'll actually make the problem worse by trenching.
You need to know.
Right. Yeah. This is one where a proper diagnosis is really important.
There you go.
Yeah, okay, I'll take a closer look. And then who do I get in touch with?
Yeah, you can give me a call at my lab. And my phone number is 608-262-2863. If you prefer to email me, my email is Huddleston, HUDELSON at WISC, short for Wisconsin, .edu, short for education.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I'll do that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. And I don't wait, Steve.
Yeah, this is one you want to catch early.
Yeah.
It won't work on the dead tree, but if you see a new tree that starts to wilt or lose branches, where branches die back, those, that's the material I need to see to diagnose.
Thanks again for calling. Sarah in Milwaukee has something for us. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Curious, is it possible that horseradish is choking out my rhubarb plant?
Is it crowding around the rhubarb?
Well, see, it's hard for me to tell. I think my dad planted horseradish in my rhubarb plant.
Horseradish is a very aggressive spreader, so it certainly could be. That wouldn't surprise me if the two of them are competing. What kind of symptoms are you seeing on your rhubarb?
Well, the rhubarb last year was a small, I mean, the rhubarb patch has been there for many years, at least 20 that I remember. And it's just been getting smaller and smaller. And this year it's just like baby stalks and there's no actual, not enough to use.
Okay, well, it could be the horseradish, but an older patch like that, if it hasn't been divided and rejuvenated in the past 5 years, it could be that it's just aging out.
And when do I do that, in the spring or the fall?
Usually best done in the spring is the best time to do it.
Okay, yeah. And then would I get rhubarb that spring?
Depends on how big your pieces are and, you know, how old it is and how vigorous it is. You might get some, but generally what we recommend after you've divided something and kind of stressed it is that you allow it to heal that year and not do a whole lot of harvesting.
Okay. Does it need a lot of fertilizer to start it out?
No.
No.
Okay,
it's pretty vigorous on its own.
Right.
To get rid of the horseradish.
Oh, that is a miserable stuff. I made that mistake many years back and lived
to regret
it.
Tell us what you really think, Larry. Well, you can certainly, you know, dig it out. I hesitate to tell you to use something like Roundup in an area where you're harvesting food, but if you want to clear out the area and then wait a while before replanting, following the directions on the product, you could use Roundup.
Or dig it out.
Yeah.
And how deep do I have to dig then?
That's another good question, because it is a tap-rooted type of plant, so you want to try and get it as deep as you can. Not knowing how big your plants are, I would say, you know, try and stick your shovel in as deep as you can get it and see kind of how deep the roots are going. I think if you get it, you know, 3-4 inches beneath the crown where the leaves come out, that probably should be sufficient.
Sure. Okay. It sounds like I'll be moving my rhubarb edge.
Yeah, sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, because the other thing I was thinking of is there might be some chemicals that are being produced by the horseradish that may be toxic to other plants.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because in that group there is some documentation. I don't know so much about plant issues, but some of those you incorporate them into soil as a green manure, and you can actually get some pathogen.
So there's some allelopathic.
There are some chemicals that are produced by that group of plants that potentially can help with disease control if you have a soil-borne pathogen. So they might be producing something that's actually toxic to the rhubarb. I don't know for certain about that, but it's something I'm thinking of.
That's interesting.
We'd
have to look that up.
Moving would be a good idea.
Yeah.
Yes. If you can.
I'll start there. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Sarah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call.
Take care of a lot of the potentials
in
one.
Yep. Orville and McElrose? Melrose. I'm sorry. My eyes are off a little bit today. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Pam was calling about the tomato racks. I have some that I made maybe 20 years ago out of rebar. If she ever wants to contact me, I can show her the cat's meow. rebar comes in 10-foot and 20-foot sections, and actually it's two-piece. So when you at the end of the year, you can lay them on top of one another, and they don't take up hardly any space. You cut the 10-foot pieces in 5-foot chunks, and then you cut 2-foot pieces, put a small arc in them about 5 inches high and then tack weld them all the way down from 10 inches apart on the top down. And then you shove them in the ground and then just tie the top with a piece of twine or whatever. And then you have a completed kind of a oval-shaped circle, which works really good. And it'll give you at least 4 to 4.5 feet of height. And they're nearly indestructible. So.
Yeah, that's for sure. You don't have a photo, though. You ever take a picture with your phone or something? You could send it
to... Well, I would send it on off an iPad or whatever, but I don't know where to send it. So.
Well, send it to the... Go on Facebook to the Larry Mueller Show.
Yeah, I don't have Facebook, so... Yeah.
Well, you could do it. You don't have to be a member of Facebook to send it.
Oh, okay.
To my site, at least, yeah.
Okay.
All right, so... Hopefully that'll pop up sometime.
Yeah. Okay. It really works nice, and they store really good, and you can add to them a little bit if you had to. So by the time you get 5 feet high, you're sticking out about a foot, but that's enough.
Yeah, that's plenty. Thank you, Orville. Appreciate your call, and do post something up on our Facebook page if you can. That would be great. The Facebook page title is the Larry Mueller Show. So there you go. Mike and Holman, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. It's tomato cages again.
Oh.
I have had tomato cages that are probably 15 years old. They're very easy to make. I make them out of concrete mesh, like they would use in your driveway. It's easily obtainable at a home improvement store like Menards or Home Depot.
Sure.
And they stand 4 foot high, and they're just a cylinder. And the squares are like 6 inches, so you can mark off the squares, and you just use make a cylinder, and then I use cable ties, you know, the plastic zip ties.
Yep.
Overlap those one square, put them together, and then cut two squares out, and that'll give you approximately 12 inches in the ground, and you just set them over your plants and wiggle them down in, and they do not tip over, and they support the plants very well.
There you go. Thank you. You know,
sure.
That's a pretty good idea, too. Might be a little less work than the rebar. You never know what you're going to learn on this show.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you what, that's a good idea. Mike, if you've got a photo of that, I'd love to see that, too. Post it up on our Facebook page if you can.
I'll do that.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. Hopefully before the show's over. That'd be wonderful. But if not, that's fine, too. But post it up sometime, hopefully today. Hopefully in the next half hour or so. Be great. Lisa and Toma, it's your turn. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I have a pagoda dogwood that for the last few years, section by section, it turns to red leaves and then it dies off. And I'm just wondering what that could be.
Yeah, I would take a look at the branches on that tree where the leaves are starting to turn red, and look to see whether you see the bark turning kind of an orange color or gold color, with maybe some orange dots. There's a disease called golden canker, which is very common on pagoda dogwood. And the fungus infects the branches and girdles them, and that can cause the branch dieback. Other things that I've seen occasionally with pagoda dogwood, sometimes if you have them in a really wet area, they can get root and crown rots that can cause branch dieback as well. But I would definitely look for those gold branches. That's probably the most common disease that I see on that host. Where's the tree located? Is it out in the sun? Is it in the shade?
In the sun next to the garage.
Yeah, that's not a great location for that particular tree. I totally understand it, why people want to put them out in the middle of the yard, because
they're
beautiful trees and everybody wants to show them off. But that's not a good environment for that tree. They're an understory tree. They like a lot of shade. They like to have their roots relatively cool and somewhat moist. And so if you put them out in the middle with a lot of grass around, you really stress them, and it makes them more prone to this golden canker disease.
And are you familiar with Siena maples?
It's a Freeman maple, one of the hybrids between red and silver.
Okay.
Is it more durable than the autumn blaze, do you think, for width?
That I couldn't tell you. The one problem with autumn blaze is that it tends to have narrow crotch angles, and I have seen a couple of times where branches have broken because it's poor architecture. I don't think that Sienna has that issue, but I would have to look up the specifics.
Yeah.
It's a nice, got good fall color, though, I can tell you that.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Debbie emailed to say that she has several shagbark hickory trees that started to bud, but the frost hit the buds, and now we have leafless trees. Will this harm the tree long term, or will they leaf out again next year?
I wonder if that's a young tree or an older established tree. If it's older and established, I'd say it probably will leaf out yet this year from the dormant buds. It's gonna, you know, it's lost energy for the tree, and it has to. I would keep it well watered. You know, if we start to get into a drought situation, if it's a young tree. I don't know.
Yeah, that could be bad news for a young tree. I'm a little surprised at this point that it hasn't leafed out already.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering about that, too. I know hickories are slow, but that's really slow.
Well, I'm glad she brought up frost, because we haven't talked about frost yet. I had yesterday a show from the Wallersheim Winery folks.
Oh, they had real serious problems.
Yeah,
they were with their grapes. They're not going to get any grapes this year off up an area. But they
a low spot, I expect.
Luckily, Philippe Cocard, who was my guest, said the plants themselves survived.
Oh, that's good.
So next year, they'll be, hopefully, if they'll get another late frost.
Yeah, the fruit growers in general, the strawberry people and the apple growers, pear growers, have all kind of took a hit this year.
Yeah, and I had a call from up north, and I think it was Washburn County, where someone had a grove of oaks, and they thought they had oak wilt because they had all the leaves had turned brown. But it was the entire grove, and we talked, and the timing was just perfect for when we had that really hard frost in May. So we have seen damage. I also had a client who had an ash tree where the leaves apparently frosted, and she was nice enough to email me back and said that it had started to re-leaf. So
that's good.
There is hopefully some hope for some of these trees.
Yeah.
Lisa, you mentioned strawberries, and that brought to mind Sue from Pulaski, who wondered why her strawberries are deformed, soft, and mushy. This is second year in a row. She said her plants look great. It's just that her fruit is bad. Or maybe... Or, Brian, you may have something.
Drosophila.
Is it a disease?
Well, I was thinking maybe spotted wing Drosophila.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very early for that. But again, we had reports in Door County already, I think even last week, that they had sightings of spotted wing Drosophila. It's a new insect pest. What I would do with those fruits is look at them very carefully and see whether or not there are any little white larvae that are in that decayed material, because that could be the larvae of this insect. And quite frankly, if you see that, I would suggest getting a sample into PJ for analysis, because they want to keep track of where that's rising in the state and when.
Yes, because we've in the past seen it in mostly in fall crop of raspberries, not the July crop, but the fall crop. And so if we're starting to see it early now in the year, that's a problem.
That would be a big problem.
Are they, you said small white, are they like a pencil point or are they bigger?
They're about a millimeter long, I'd say.
Yeah, they're very tiny.
Yeah.
Probably
okay,
you might be able to see them crawling around, but it'd be good if you had a hand lens to be able to see them really well. The thing is, they need to be reared, I think, to adults in order to verify that they're spotted wings. So that's why we'd like to see samples of those coming in to our insect lab.
Okay, so that she would send that into the insect diagnostic lab.
Yeah, insect diagnostic lab. It's 1630 Linden Drive. And in Madison.
If you just Google insect
diagnostic lab, it's got all the contact
information. To find it, because we do have, by the way, a fact sheet on that on Brian's website that was written by Christelle Godot, one of our entomologists. And
with a
she
photo?
Did a lot of.
Yes.
There is a photo.
Yeah, photo of both the adults and the larvae on that as well.
Right, and they've been tracking the insect across the state.
So it's important to go ahead if you, you know, if you
suspect that, get a sample in, because if it would be something this early, that would be I think big
bad news.
Yeah, bad news. And my website, if you want to look up the fact sheet, is pddc.wisc.edu. And there's a fact sheet section. Just click on that, select all, and then it's all alphabetical. Look under spotted wing Drosophila.
So what is it again?
Where's... PDDC, so that's short for Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, .wisc.edu.
We'll post that up on our Facebook page, too, just in case. Let's turn to Terry and Amro next. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Yeah, I have a couple of, well, I think they're clump maples, and they are leaning over my garden and dropping seed all over the place. So I want to cut them down, but I don't know what that's going to do to the shade plants that I have under there. And I do have another birch, a clump birch, that is being overwhelmed by the maple, and I'm wondering how long that's going to take to fill in, you know, once the maples are gone.
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask what type of plants are under your maple.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
Wild ginger and hasta and astilbe, you know, kind of your typical shade perennials.
Yeah. Well, they're not going to be happy. Let's put it that way.
I know this from personal experience.
Oh, no.
It may not kill them, but you probably will have some burned leaves. I guess of the group that you mentioned, I would be most concerned about the astilbe in terms of they are the most water requiring of the bunch there. So I would make sure to water those heavily. And the hosta are the most likely to burn.
Oh, okay. How long does it typically take a tree to fill out once you've got that competing tree right next to it? And does that take a couple years, or will that fill out right away?
Probably at least a couple of years, I'd say. And you're talking a birch, which does not cast a whole lot of shade.
Right.
You know, it's
And what kind of birch is
it?
Yeah,
that's another question.
Oh, I don't know. A clump,
Is it white? White bark?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Then I worry about the maple providing shade for the birch, which is actually beneficial to the birch, because if they get stressed, then there's a boring insect that can come in and kill them off. So you might have problems even with the birch tree.
You're in Amro, so you're a little north, and that could help.
That
at
will
least
help the birch tree a little bit, especially down here in the southern part of the state. White bark birches are just not happy because they're not native here, and they don't like our hot, humid summers and our heavy clay soil and being put on the south side of a house with
grass all around.
Yeah, that's like the best recipe for stress for a white bark birch that you can get.
Okay, I guess I'm going to have to rethink this.
Think about it.
Or set up some artificial shading. I think that might be another thing
to
think
about. Yeah, that's a great idea.
It might not look as aesthetically pleasing as what you'd like, but at least until you can get other things filled in a little bit, that might help you, particularly with those herbaceous plants underneath.
It could even be as simple as like snow fence with some shade cloth spread over the top, or fencing of some kind. Or maybe you have some really cool garden art that you can put out there.
Sure thing. Good. On that happy note.
Yeah.
I'm always full of really wonderful thoughts.
I want to remind you, you're listening to Garden Talk. Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson. Joe in Clinton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Joe. Thanks for waiting.
Sure.
What can we do for you?
We planted a couple pear trees last 2 years ago, small pear trees, and they've been doing fine. We planted another one this year, and all of a sudden all of them have, I guess it's called leaf curl, where the stem sort of starts to spiral. And I was wondering what we do about that, if it'll just go away, if it's maybe just a bad year, or if we need to start treating it with something.
So these are pear trees, not peach?
Pear trees.
Pears, yep. Okay. Yeah, I first read that as peach, and I was going to answer one way. But with a pear tree, you're seeing the little stems or the petioles and the leaves are kind of curly-cued?
Yep.
Yeah, my guess is that it probably got a little bit of a dose of some sort of herbicide. Because that's a typical symptom that we see on plants that are exposed to what are called growth regulator herbicides. They're very common in lawn care products. Or if you're out in the country, they're oftentimes used for treating agricultural crops for weeds.
That's a perfect explanation.
Yeah, you may see other plants that will start to show similar symptoms as well.
If my red bud is doing the exact same thing, the tips, new growth,
yep.
The
looks very fringy.
All...
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that's most likely an herbicide exposure.
Oh, okay.
All right, there you go.
That was simple enough.
All right.
It should grow out of it. The new growth should recover.
Yeah.
All right, I appreciate it.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
Although I had a tomato that came in this year that had really, really bad herbicide to the point where the growing points had dried up and were dead. So that had gotten a fairly high dose. Of course, tomatoes are incredibly sensitive. They're a great indicator plant if you want to know if you've got herbicide drift.
Yeah. Redbud is pretty
red
good,
bud is
too,
very
as
great.
Far as...
Grape is quite good as well.
For woody plants.
We've well, let's go to our Facebook page for a look there, because Mark sent us something, and he says, help, something's killing my honeysuckle. It's about 5 years old, and up until a week ago, it was so vigorous that I actually added more trellis for it to grow on. Suddenly, the whole plant started to dry up and wilt. And got quite a photo of it here. Don't see any signs of insect damage, though.
Yeah, there's not enough detail to be able to... Brian was wondering about a disease. I'm wondering about, since you said it happened suddenly, I'm wondering if there's any... like rabbit damage at the base that might have happened over winter, or any kind of injury that would have damaged the vascular system so that the plant is not getting enough water. But Brian has an alternate explanation.
Yeah, of course. My mind goes to something like verticillium wilt, although I usually don't think of honeysuckle as being a great host for that particular fungus. But that's another one, like we discussed oak wilt, where it gets in and it blocks off water movement. And verticillium comes in through the roots, colonizes the water conducting tissue and blocks it off. And that will lead to wilt. And the symptoms look similar to what I would expect with verticillium wilt. But the only way to verify that would be to see a sample of the vines in the clinic, you know, cut right at the soil line. And then we try to grow the fungus out of the vines. It'd be very interesting if we did find it in there. Again, I don't think of honeysuckle as being a great host, but it's probably been reported as a host somewhere in the past.
Yeah. Now, if it is verticillium, that's a soil-borne organism,
right.
And you wouldn't want to plant a susceptible plant back in there again.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons we recommend getting a diagnosis for that, because if you have verticillium, it really limits what you can put back in.
Yeah. So I would check the base of the plant for injury and also consider sending in a sample to Brian if you don't see injury.
Judy in Custer has a question. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Larry and Gis. I have two tree questions. They are both rather benign. The first is about maple trees. We live in the middle of an oak woods with some paper birch and evergreens, but more and more maples are taking over as the succession. Where the other trees grow, there's lots of undergrowth. There are blackberries and wild currant and choke cherries and all other things. Where the maples grow, underneath that, there is nothing except this lovely sedge grass.
Oh, I know what's going on there.
You do? Oh,
I think you've got jumping worms, I hate to tell you.
really?
Yeah, actually, Bernie Williams from the DNR was just giving us a talk about that. And the Penn sedge, Pennsylvania sedge, does tend to colonize areas, first of all, to begin with. But it can be kind of an indicator that maybe you have that. Have you seen jumping worms?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
No, I haven't. And
the grass itself is very pretty. It's very short.
Yeah, it's also flowing. Kind of invasive. It's not the healthiest understory. So, you know, maples to begin with tend to have a wider leaf, and that tends to shade out understory. So in general, in maple woods, you don't see as much understory, except for like ephemerals in the spring.
Yeah.
And the pensedge does, you know, if it gets started in there, it's not the best stuff.
Hard to dig out, too, I would expect, because the maple roots are pretty shallow.
Shallow, yeah.
They are, and the sedge has rather very deep clumping growth. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Is there anything that I should, I mean, should I try to remove it or what? It's very pretty.
Yeah, I know it is. The problem is that it's crowding out everything else that you might have. You know, I'm not really sure what to do in that situation. You might go to, I'm trying to think of what resources to send her to.
Probably first would be to get an indication of whether there is jumping worm there.
Yeah.
So,
do I just dig up some and see if I find some?
Yeah, usually they'll be in front of the pensedge area.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of, she called it a worm front, because they don't like to live in that area either. You may find them in there.
Okay.
You can check out the DNR's website.
Yeah.
On
just jumping
type
worms.
In. Yeah. That's been a big issue this spring, but we're finding them in many counties. So, you know, it's like the cat is out of the bag already.
Yeah.
The worm is out of the out of the soil.
Well, I didn't expect that kind of answer, but that's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah,
my second question has to do with a Northern Star cherry, and my son gave it to me about 20-plus years ago. And I planted it in the middle of a perennial bed because that was a good spot and it was very pretty and it was doing well. But over the years, I kept having sprouts of something, woody plants, coming up. So although I didn't weed that very much, when those things came up, I pulled them and discovered long roots and cut off the roots. Then I discovered that branches on my cherry tree were dying. And then I discovered that along the edge of the bed, where I don't do anything, there was this whole little row of cherry saplings that actually bloomed and had some cherries.
Huh.
So now I've been letting these things come up. I recognize them now as cherry saplings. And I don't know what to do. I could have just let them grow and have a whole little cherry orchard there, or maybe kind of thin them out because there are too many of them. Or I could dig them up and pot them up and put them out in a different orchard where there's more room. But would that harm my original tree? That's it. It's kind of a nice problem, but it's strange.
Yeah.
A lot of the fruit trees are very prone to sending up suckers. That's what we call them. They actually come from the rootstock and not from the variety of tree that you have. So when they do start to produce fruit, it probably won't be the variety that you have, so it won't be North Star. They also tend to be, if you have a dwarf tree, for example, or a semi-dwarf, the rootstock may not produce a dwarf or semi-dwarf tree. It may produce a taller tree. So usually, you know, if you cut off suckers, it's usually not going to hurt the major or the main tree, but you need to make a clean cut with your pruners when you do that. But it's very common for fruit trees to do that. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, the only comment was that you may not get the fruit that you were expecting because it's coming from the rootstock.
Yeah. All fruit trees are grafted. That's how because they don't come true from seed, that's how we're able to mass produce the varieties that we want, is that we have to graft the top that has the variety you want onto a more vigorous type of rootstock.
Okay, thank you. I will So far, the little trees along the edge that have already started blossoming have borne fruit that's the same as that on the mother tree. But I think that's very good advice. I can get out my clean pruners and take care of the other.
Go to work.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Thanks,
Thank
Judy.
Thank you so much.
Yep. Appreciate the call. We had Jeanette post on Facebook to say her beets look like they have fungal disease. What can she do to stop this besides not watering too much?
It really depends on the particular disease that she's talking about. So that's very, very vague, and I can't really comment too much on that without seeing or having more detail.
Can she send us a photo?
If she can send a photo, that would be wonderful. We could take a look at it. Steve emailed to ask for suggestions on when and what products to use for leaf spot, blight, etc. on tomatoes. He mulches, uses cages, and selects disease-resistant plants.
Yeah, if you're really desperate to spray, and I don't normally recommend this for home gardeners, quite frankly, but you could use copper-containing products. Make sure you get a product that's labeled for use on vegetable crops, specifically tomato. There is an active ingredient called chlorothalonil, which is also it would be a non-organic option that, again, you could use for control. Again, you need a particular product that's labeled for use on tomatoes or vegetables. And you need to get that material on very, very early because these are preventative products. They will not cure existing infections. You need to get them on before you see disease.
And you also need to check the product for the treatment harvest interval.
That's right.
So that it tells you how long between application and when you can harvest and safely eat the fruit.
Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Our guest for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest Brian Huddleston of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. And we've talked about leaf diseases and cold injuries and a whole variety of questions. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Edie in Heartland, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Hopefully I don't cut out because I'm having trouble. I have a service berry I've had for years. Some years it's good, some years it's bad. This year it bloomed as good as years, and all the leaves look like they're mottled. They have some holes in them, look rusty, and the berries are turning black before they're opening.
Ooh.
Holes sound more like an insect problem, so I'm not sure exactly what's going on.
Just as I was walking back in the house, too.
Yeah. I don't know what would be causing the fruit to turn black.
I just noticed today. I was waiting for them to ripen. I just noticed today they're all like getting real tiny and then breaking up, you know,
mm-hmm.
or getting black. So, yeah.
Yeah, service berries are really tough from a disease standpoint. I don't usually see a lot of them come into my clinic with disease problems. So that's why I'm wondering whether there's something insect-wise that's going on rather than a disease problem.
Have you looked at the fruits carefully?
Well, like I said, I didn't notice till today they were shriveling up and not actually become a fruit, so I can, yeah. I haven't yet.
But they're shriveling up, though. They're not turning mushy, or?
They look hard as a rock, actually. I didn't touch them, but they look hard as a rock.
Okay.
Huh.
Yeah, and no idea.
Yeah, no, that's, like I said, from a disease standpoint, I see very few problems on service berry. That's a tree, actually, that I recommend a lot for planting in a variety of situations.
Yeah, it's so pretty when it blooms with all the white flower early and everything. Yeah. Last year, I had tons of berries. The birds just loved it. And this year, they don't have any. So,
You said the leaves are rusty?
They look almost like a rust disease, you know, but then there's some holes in them also.
Is it really bright orange color, or is it just kind of a brownish, rusty brown?
Brownish.
Okay. Because I do see cedar apple rust occasionally on that particular plant, but those would be very bright spots, and it wouldn't be across the entire leaf.
Yeah,
the only thing I could suggest, if you're interested, would be to get a sample into my clinic. We can take a look or send it to the insect diagnostic lab for PJ to look at for insect problems.
Yeah. Is it the whole tree, or is it just selected branches?
everywhere.
Well, that
have
you checked the base of the tree to see if there's any damage from rabbits or something that might have? Yeah.
Yeah, right at the base of the trunk. Is there any indication that the bark's been removed?
Not that I noticed, but I'll look closer. It looked normal to me. In the fact, I noticed all this week the leaves have been getting worse and worse and worse. So I thought perfect time to call you guys. So
the other thing would be to look at the root system as well, because if there's a root or crown rot, something of that sort, that could cause pretty massive leaves to dry up just because the tree can't take up enough water. But that's about the only thing I can come up with from a disease standpoint that could cause this sort of symptoms.
As major as I thought it was, right? This is pretty major.
Yeah, it sounds like if the entire tree is affected and it's happened very rapidly, it may be something in the root system.
Yeah, and again, either the vascular system being disrupted by girdling or by root rot, either way you get the same effect.
Yeah,
it's not in an area that's been flooded recently, has it? Or
no, not really. No. It's just the front of my house, and it's pretty level there, and it's next to a bunch of flower beds. My cone flowers are huge, and they're looking great. And around the corner are some spring blooming bushes, and they look fine. So that's the only thing I see wrong. So
I think you stumped us. I think the root rot could. I mean, if it's the whole tree,
it's something going on with the vascular system. Then probably.
So should I just take a small thing and dig up around it? Would that be a start or no?
What I would do. Do you have a digital camera?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I would take some pictures and email them to me.
Okay, to Huddleston. Is it again?
Yeah, Huddleston at wisc.edu. wisc.edu. I can take a look. I may not be able to tell much even from a photo, but I can get a better sense of what might be going on. And then
pictures too.
Yeah, leaves, kind of the landscape, so I can see what's around the tree. I want to see what the leaves look like. And then the base of the trunk, that sort of stuff.
And my birds are going to be real disappointed this year.
Yeah.
And I have one other question. It's a hibiscus, an annual hibiscus that I put in the basement. Kind of in a sweet spot for 2 years. It blooms beautifully. This year it's a double hibiscus. This year I didn't get it too near the light. It bloomed all winter. Now I brought it out here and it looks just horrible. It keeps losing leaves and they're getting like brown edges on.
Did you move it right outside from inside?
I put it in shade first.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Did you have it outside during that cold snap?
I had it out after that. It's only been out for, I'd say, at the most 2 weeks right now.
Has it been repotted recently?
That was the next thing I was going to ask.
Has it been repotted recently?
Yes, because I was worried it was doing so bad, so I repotted it. I did the worst thing I could have done, I guess. Huh?
No, not necessarily. My concern was if it's been in the same pot for a while, and if you've been fertilizing it at all, it could be salts. You could have a salt buildup, which is causing the problem. That marginal sort of browning on the leaves indicates to me that there's a water issue. So something's preventing it from getting enough water. And in potted plants, I worry about salt buildup over time. So if you transplanted it, it may recover. Did you notice when you transplanted it any signs of soft roots or any weird smell or anything?
And I used potted soil. I put a little compost in. I used mainly potting soil.
Okay.
And I'll be really honest with you, I potted it twice because it looks so bad over the first time. I thought I went to too big a pot, so I went back to the pot it was in. This was because I think they like to be a little cramped in pots, right?
A little, but if it was really pot-bound with a lot of circling roots and, a really hard root mass, then you definitely did the right thing by moving it up. Usually we don't advise a pot any bigger than 2 inches in diameter, bigger than the old pot.
Yeah, and that's about all I did. Yeah, so I'm just being unlucky this year, I guess. I don't know. I have a white mini rose that I bought last year. It turned out to be not a mini, so I moved it to the side of the house. It was just gorgeous, but it had 8 to 10 foot stems, 8 to 10 inch stems. Just gorgeous. But then it got all this brown stuff on it. So I talked to Melinda Meyer, and she said, that's fire blight. And I said, I don't think so. I looked up in the book. So I sprayed it with fungus. Antifungus, because that's all I had in the house, took 3 sprays and it was fine. This year it's got 8 flowers on it already, about 10 inches tall, and it's starting to get the brown again.
Interesting.
Well, you've got a whole litany of problems here, Edie.
Yeah.
And we haven't been able to help a lot, but I think we're at our wit's end here. But get a hold of Brian.
Yeah, send me some photos of, you can send me photos of the hibiscus as well, and also the rose, if you want to. And it may not be a disease problem, but if I have a sense of what it is, I can forward it on to other folks who might be able to give you some help.
There we go. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Larry in Green Bay up next. Hi, Larry.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I guess.
Yeah, what can we do for you?
I've got a few ornamental cherry trees that started a few years back to develop a crusty canker, a black crust on the branches. And our first thought was to remove those, and it came back even worse. And we've been trying to, we've been reading both that to remove it or to leave it. I've heard that people have pruned it out and the tree to end up dying kind of thing. So I was wondering if we had an answer for that.
Yes. Yeah, is it a kind of a swollen area on the branch that you're talking about?
Correct.
Yeah, it looks like what I affectionately call poop on a stick.
Pretty close, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's a disease called black knot. And it's a fungal disease, and usually a recommendation is to prune that out. It's unfortunate, though, that certain varieties of cherries tend to be very, very susceptible, so you can have multiple infections. And quite frankly, the first year of infection, you won't see much of a swelling at all. You may just see some roughening of the bark. It's only after 2 years that you get a real distinctive gall or swollen area on those branches. So the reason why you may have seen additional disease after you pruned was just that the tree was already infected and they just further developed in a year's time. So the recommendation typically is to prune those out about 4 to 6 inches below where you see the swollen tissue. The thing of it is, if you've got a lot of it in the tree, you do so much pruning that we recommend what we call a basal prune. So just remove the tree and start over again, unfortunately. The other thing you can do, it doesn't oftentimes kill the tree. So it can live with this particular disease. So if it's a fruit-bearing cherry, and it's still bearing a lot of good fruit, you could just leave those swollen areas in the branches. It's not very aesthetically pleasing, particularly in the wintertime, and it can produce spores that could infect other cherry trees in your property, but that is an option.
You have to disinfect your pruning shears, right?
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's in general, yeah. Anytime you're pruning, usually I keep some 70% alcohol, so rubbing alcohol around in a container and just dip them, let them sit for about 30 seconds. Best of all possible worlds is to do that between every cut, but most people don't want to wait that long to do pruning.
But you can move it around that
way. You can move it around that way. So I definitely recommend decontaminating your tools between trees just to make sure. And that's a general recommendation anytime you're pruning.
All right. There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have another photo on our Facebook page from Adam, a potted avocado tree about 4 feet tall here in Madison that seems to have some sort of blight. Periodically, new growth shrivels and old leaves will yellow and fall in between these attacks. The tree grows fairly vigorously. Older leaves have almost all started to show spots that are particularly visible when held up to the light. And Adam has a photo showing a leaf, and there's sort of black edges.
And again, that sort of pattern to the brown spots where it's all very marginal usually indicates to me that it's probably not a disease problem.
Okay.
Usually diseases, if they're fungal diseases, they're much more random on the leaf surface. And that marginal sort of pattern sometimes can be fertility related. And I'm just wondering, given that the tree resprouts, whether or not that's just part of the normal aging
of some of the leaves. Yeah, and also that it's on the it's on the older leaves that might be getting shaded out that may be part of its normal growth pattern. I'm not that familiar with avocados.
Yeah, me either, but that's just the first thing that comes to mind, that may not be a disease problem. It may simply be that the trees are just losing older leaves producing
new
ones.
That's what I'm thinking, yeah.
All right, let's take a call from Teresa in Tomahawk next. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm pretty excited. Our Honeycrisp blossomed for the very first time after planting it 7 years ago. We also have a Harrelson and a Hazelton next to them, interspersed with some lilacs. Last year, we had some leaf rollers attacking the Honeycrisp, and we did a vigorous cut because we didn't want to spray anything. And this year, we did get an organic spray and sprayed the trees prior to the blossoming because we knew, you know, we didn't want to hurt the bees. But now, and we did the blossoms, and we have some apples, which we're so excited. But now we have on the north side of the tree brown leaves that look like they're drying. And we've done some investigation, and the bark and the stems, there's no, you know, putting, there's no weeping, and we're not quite sure if it was frost or if it was the insecticide or what that might be causing the brown leaves.
Yeah, so the leaves are kind of crisp and totally crisp, and it's on yes. entire branches?
Yes.
Yeah, my concern would be some sort of what we call a canker disease. So it's a localized infection in that individual branch, and these organisms will girdle the branch, and that will cause anything from that infection point all the way out to the tip to die. And there are a variety of different organisms that potentially can cause this sort of symptom. The big one that I worry about on apples, but I'd have to check the particular variety about whether it's resistant or not, would be fire blight. That's a bacterial disease. There are fungal pathogens that will also cause very similar symptoms. And so the typical recommendation is to prune out those branches. But the concern is how far back to prune. If it's fungal, it's about 4 to 6 inches below where you see the dead leaves. If it's okay. bacterial, though, it's more like 12 inches back. And so you've got to go much farther back if it happens to be bacterial. And I can't really tell you which one of those it might be. But usually pruning is the way to manage those sorts of diseases.
Well, is it safe to prune now? I mean, I wouldn't think it would be, but I'd like to get that off because I don't...
Yeah.
There's no browning on the side where the apples are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's on the north side of the tree.
Sure. My suggestion would be if you've got a period of dry weather that looks like it's going to be relatively dry, no rain, go ahead and prune that out. My concern is if it is something like fire blight, that particular pathogen can move pretty quickly, and you want to try to get that out of the tree as quickly as possible. Most of the time, I'm an advocate of winter pruning, but with that disease, I think it's better to get it out quickly.
Okay, well, that's what we'll do. We have 2 days of dry weather. We're pretty wet up here in Tomahawk.
Okay, good luck to you. Thanks, Teresa. And let's turn to Pete in Milwaukee, who has online but also has a picture on Facebook.
Hi. I've got a picture of a Honeycrisp apple tree first and then the Rainier cherry tree in the back. And both seem to have the curling of the leaves, which I posted. I couldn't post them at the same time. But I'm just concerned about it. The Honeycrisp tree is only a little over a year old, but the cherry tree is probably 5 years old. Is there anything I can do with that?
Yeah, I can't see a lot of detail. Excuse me. I can't see a lot of detail in your photos. So you're seeing distorted growth on the leaves?
Well, the leaves are curling in really tight.
Yeah.
It could be a leaf roller.
Yeah, I would definitely check inside to see if you see any indication of any insects inside those curled
or
leaves.
Or aphids.
Okay. Can
Is
I
it all
spray the
leaves?
Tree? Is it too late? I mean, the cherry tree, it's too late for because I've already got the cherries coming out. But the new one, I want it to survive. And I have another Honeycrisp tree that you can't see in the picture that's a lot bigger.
Okay. But you're seeing it on the apple as well as the cherry?
Yeah.
And is it all over the tree or is it just individual small areas
well,
on the tree?
And the Honeycrisp tree is still new, so it's in small areas. The cherry tree is so big now, it looks like it's over 20 feet tall, that I can't possibly spray the leaves on that one.
Mm-hmm. No, I was just wondering, trying to get a sense of whether it's just a small number of leaves or whether it's the entire tree, because if it were the entire tree, I might be inclined to think about herbicides again.
Yeah.
But if it's just a few clumps of leaves here or there, then I think the leaf rollers are a better or more likely option.
Yeah, or aphids causing some distorted growth. Or it could even be if it happened after the frost, it could be...
Cold injury, too.
Yeah, cold injury.
Yeah, we have seen some leaves that have been very distorted because they were just coming out when we had the frost, and part of the leaf got damaged, the other part didn't. And then as they continue to expand, they get very odd shapes.
Okay, can I take a picture of the leaf opened and send it to your website?
Yeah, go ahead and do that.
Yeah, you can take several.
Yeah, take a whole bunch and go ahead and send that to my email address, and we can take a look and see whether or not it looks like a disease problem, or if not, I can, again, forward those on.
All right, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. What was your email address again?
It's Huddleson, Huddelson, at WISC. WISC.edu.
And on to John in Wausau. Hi, John.
Hey, how's it going? I love this show. It's really wonderful.
Thank you.
I've got two questions. I have a white oak. It's about 100 years old. And recently, it tends to drop leaves a lot in the summer. You know, I don't know if that's normal, like clusters of them.
That's maybe squirrels.
Squirrels again.
Could be squirrels.
Oh, okay. Well, I got a lot of those for sure. Okay, and I've got what someone told me were sapsuckers coming to it. And the bird, the sapsucker, I guess.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, is that a harbinger of illness of the tree, or is that just something that they kind of visit and go? I don't see any holes in it or anything. But since it was dropping leaves, now that I know it's squirrels, I feel a little better about that. But I'm wondering if when you see one of those birds visiting a tree, if it means there's a problem.
Well, sapsuckers typically will create rows of holes if they are feeding.
Uh-huh.
And it should be pretty visible. So if you're saying you're not seeing any holes, I'm wondering if it is sapsuckers.
I would doubt that it's sapsucker. I agree with Lisa. You'd see a row of holes and probably several rows of very even holes.
They're very, when they prospect, they go at it.
Okay, yeah, because they sort of hang out on the tree and they kind of hop a little bit. And
that could be a different type of bird.
Yeah, maybe some other type of bird.
Yeah, could be nuthatches. Nuthatches usually walk upside down.
Oh, really? Yeah, because they do that too. It's like a gray, white, and black kind of
bird. Yeah, it sounds like a nuthatch.
Yeah.
Oh, so I'm relieved about that. The other one is I have a silver birch. And it's got some sort of blistering going on. I've noticed it for the last few years that it has like a fungus or something on it.
Blistering on the leaves?
Yeah, yeah.
Leaf miner.
Yeah, it could be. It could also be one of the gall formers on birch
well.
Yeah. Does it look like a little shag carpet by any chance?
And the tree itself?
No, the damage you're seeing on the leaves.
No, they're like almost like blisters.
Okay. It could be some sort of insect issue. Most of the time on a mature tree, those are going to be probably cosmetic.
Yeah. And
okay.
Leaf miner, what it tends to do is the adult lays its egg on the leaf, and the larva will feed between the top and the bottom layer. So often you do get this kind of
bubbling
kind of look. If you hold the leaf up to the light, often you can see the larva in there and the little black fecal pellets that they leave behind. But Brian, like he said, it's usually if it's a mature tree, it's pretty much of a cosmetic issue.
And with that, thanks a lot, John. With that, we are finished for the day. Boy, it's been a great show with lots of good calls. Guys, thank you so much for being with us. You'll come back.
Happy to come back anytime.
Thanks for asking.
Brian Huddleson, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Lisa Johnson is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Great to have them along. We'll have them back for sure. It's lots of fun, and they've got lots of great information. Monday, our physical therapist will be joining us, and then next week on Garden Talk, Melinda Myers stops by. But there's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, so you stay with us.